Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
If you've ever walked through an old cemetery, you've seen those heartbreaking headstones. Women who died at 19 or 23 or 36. We can't know for sure how many of them died in childbirth, but the disproportionate number of young women buried in those old cemeteries is a stark reminder of how far medical science has come over the past couple of centuries. So a new report that the number of Texas women dying during or soon after childhood has risen dramatically in recent years, it is cause for alarm. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. A study by the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology found the maternal mortality rate in Texas doubled between 2010 and 2012 alone. And the authors noted it's hard to explain that increase in the absence of something like war or natural disaster or severe economic upheaval. Journalist Marissa Evans reports on health and human services policies for the Texas Tribune. She's been working to find an explanation and discovered that while so-called modern medicine certainly exists in our times, too many Texas women don't have access to it. You can find a link to her article, Dangerous Deliveries, Is Texas Doing Enough to Stop Moms from Dying, at think.kera.org. And Marissa Evans joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin to talk about it. Marissa, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
All right. First, I want to get a sense of these numbers. It would seem that mothers' deaths associated with childbirth would be a fairly straightforward thing to tabulate. So why is that in dispute?
Well, it's in dispute for a couple of reasons. The way that the different definitions behind maternal mortality differs. So for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they have their own way of counting it. And then at the state level, we have our own definition of counting it, too. So when you have these two very important agencies, in our case, the Texas Department of State Health Services and the Federal Centers for Disease Control, saying we're counting it in these different ways and we have these different numbers to show for it, that's where we come into having a problem.
But everybody agrees the numbers in Texas are on the rise?
Exactly. Everyone that I talked to with our reporting said, regardless of what the numbers are, you know, these numbers shouldn't be where they are. They are rising. There are women dying. And, you know, no matter how you look at the definitions, you know, people still need to be paying attention to this issue. And we still need to kind of figure out what we can do to protect mothers as they prepare for childbirth.
Is this happening in a lot of other states, too? Are maternal mortality rates increasing all over the country?
It is. You know, that's actually another reason, too, why Texas is still not doing great, but we're not the only ones. That is something very important to note. You have states like Mississippi who are also seeing a rise in maternal mortality. You know, California once at one time saw a rise too, but they've started to lower their rate, which has been a really big news for public health world. So, like I said, you know, it's rising everywhere, but in Texas, we're still considered a top 10 place for that happening.
I want to be clear here. The numbers in any given year, including the worst years in Texas, are still low enough to mean that it's rare for a woman to die after she's given birth. But if I understand correctly, the concern is that a lot of these deaths are still probably unnecessary.
Exactly. You know, and that's something that we heard time and time again from a lot of the women's health experts and doctors that we talked to. It's very one of the saddest things that can happen in the medical profession, but it's also thankfully very rare. The problem is that it's so rare that people are still just realizing that this is still a thing that happens in the United States. And a lot of these deaths are preventable. You have women who are enduring C-sections, who maybe didn't get prenatal care, who weren't able to get their postpartum visit in time, because it happens so quickly after giving birth, within a matter of hours, days, or weeks. So I think a lot of people don't realize what a important and critical time it is after a woman gives birth.
And what are the kinds of problems? Okay, I think we understand, you know, if a woman is hemorrhaging immediately mm-hmm. after giving birth, or if a woman has complications from a C-section, mm-hmm. what kinds of potentially lethal problems can happen in like the weeks after a woman gives birth?
That's a great question. So one of the big things that we found was blood clots, you know, that can go into a woman's lungs. swelling of certain swelling can also be an indicator of that as well. Strokes can happen. You have women who saw a rapid rise in their blood pressure in the days after giving birth. So postpartum preeclampsia is what it's called. So all of these things are very sudden and very alarming. And oftentimes women don't, maybe they're told, you know, these are the things you need to be looking for. But when you're about to take care of a newborn, you might not even be thinking about your own health and your own safety. You're thinking about keeping your newborn alive. You're thinking about what does he or she need as they come into this world.
Right. And of course, your body's on such a roller coaster anyway mm-hmm. that it can be hard to know what's not
exactly.
normal.
Yeah. Emotionally, physically, all of that. I mean, I think so often we're having conversations now about postpartum depression, which is wonderful and very great. We're doing great work in terms of eliminating that stigma. But, you know, in terms of the physical things you can see, such as not just hemorrhaging, but strokes, heart attacks, high blood pressure, those are things that I think doctors are having a hard time educating women about.
I was interested and saddened to read that suicide is a mm-hmm. pretty serious risk for mothers who've recently given birth.
Right. And I think, you know, the legislature here in Texas has done some work on postpartum depression, making sure more women are getting screening, access to treatment. But, you know, we're still trying to have conversations as a society about what postpartum depression looks like. What does it mean? What does it encompass? I mean, I think people just assume, well, you're just tired. And that's not what postpartum depression is. It's much deeper than that. It's much more difficult to talk about for some women and for some families, you know. And there are a lot of women who are just now getting to a point where they're openly talking about it. But we still have so much work to do to eliminate that stigma and to make sure women are getting the help that they need.
All right. In 2013, the state legislature established this task force on maternal mortality and morbidity. What did that task force discover about, first of all, who is most at risk of dying during or after childbirth in Texas?
Mm-hmm. The task force has found in their research so far that it's mostly Black women who are at most risk of dying after childbirth or having complications. A lot of the women that they've studied are also women who might be in Medicaid, might have to pay out of pocket for their insurance, or might have no insurance at all. It's women over 40. So these women come from various walks of life, but the running consistent theme was that Black women are the most at risk of dying after childbirth.
Can anybody figure out why Black women are more at risk than other women of color, even when socioeconomics are factored in?
Well, I found in my reporting, you know, when I've asked that same question, you know, we really can't talk about Black women and Black maternal health unless we're talking about systemic racism in the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. You know, you have women who do not feel like they can talk to their doctors. You have unconscious bias against Black women when they're trying to ask questions or perceptions about if they'll follow their doctor's orders when it comes to their health plan. So all of that is a very important distinct factor, too, in terms of how do we welcome Black women into the healthcare system. I think a really important example in the last few weeks alone has been with Serena Williams telling her own story in Vogue magazine about her own pregnancy complications and how she had to fight her doctors to get the care she needed. And so I think that was a really powerful statement that's going to actually help a lot more people think about how do they perceive Black women, how do they perceive Black mothers, and also just in general about how we listen to women and their postpartum period. You know, I think it's very easy to write it off as like, well, this is normal. And well, no, we know what scans look for. But I think, you know, medical professionals have to think about, it's great that you have that training, but women, and particularly I think mothers after giving birth, know their bodies better than anybody else.
What changed in Texas with regard to access to family planning services in 2011?
In 2011, the legislature voted to essentially cut family planning services. They cut $73.6 million. And another thing that they did is they made it so that groups that offer women's health services but also have affiliates that offer abortions cannot participate in that program. And that was a really big deal because most people felt as if they were targeting Planned Parenthood and trying to make sure that they could not offer care. And the reason why that matters is because at the time, Planned Parenthood was one of the bigger providers in the family planning program. And so after that, you know, when they did not have access to that funding, many of their clinics closed. A lot of clinics that were not necessarily Planned Parenthood ones had to close because they do have affiliates that offer abortion. And so many people kind of felt as if it was a political scheme, basically, to make sure that Planned Parenthood couldn't participate. And that's had an impact on women.
So I understand that state lawmakers, speaking for a lot of Texas voters, don't want to spend state funds on government-funded abortions. But why go after the clinics that aren't providing that?
It has a lot to do, I think, with stigma. I found in my reporting, not everyone understands the structures of how Planned Parenthood works. I think people have a hard time buying the idea that not all Planned Parenthood clinics offer abortions. It's important to note that they have to keep those entities separate. So they have specific surgical centers that do abortions, not in their other clinics. Those other clinics are doing the work with prenatal care. They're doing STD testing, birth control counseling, all of those very important reproductive health services that women need. So they're not all doing abortions. I think that's been a really big thing that has been really difficult for Planned Parenthood to overcome, because not only because of, you know, the general arguments and discussions around abortion and access to abortion right now, but also because of the big news that happened a couple of years ago with, fetal remains and how those are handled for research.
So you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that that cut in 2011 took $73.6 million away from state-funded family planning services. Mm-hmm. That was out of a budget that was, I don't want to say only, but out of a budget of $111 million before. So this is well over 50%.
Right, exactly. And, you know, what's great is that, you know, Texas has been able to create new types of women's health programs. It wasn't simply they cut the program and then they left nothing. You know, they kind of reorganized it to create their own women's health program that works for, that's Texas run and works for them. But there were consequences to doing that. I mean, it wasn't necessarily just cutting the budget. We were kicked out of the Medicaid women's health program, which at the time was serving 105,000 women per year, because the Obama administration said you basically can't deny a woman's right to choose who she goes to get her health care done by, even if it is a Planned Parenthood. So in doing that, in trying to take that stand, we were eliminated from the program. And so there are women who have fell through the cracks in the last few years because of these constant changes to the women's health programs that we've had.
So ultimately, the state called the Obama administration's bluff. The administration probably thought that states would cave on these kinds of policies, and Texas did not.
Essentially, that's mm-hmm. a great way to put it. Yes. I think that they thought, you know, they won't want to lose all these millions of dollars that's covering all these thousands and thousands of women. So maybe they'll give in. But Texas, we're not a give in type of state when it comes to these issues. We, our legislators take, you know, reproductive rights, as most particularly pro-life issues, very, very seriously. So it was definitely something that I think advocates were disappointed by when they chose to continue with that. And then we subsequently got eliminated from the Medicaid Women's Health Program.
My guest is journalist Marissa Evans. She reports on health and human services policies for the Texas Tribune. Her article, Dangerous Deliveries, Is Texas Doing Enough to Stop Moms from Dying? You can find a link to it at think.kera.org. If you want to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We are at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Marissa Evans of the Texas Tribune, who reports for them on health and human services policies. Her recent article is called Dangerous Deliveries. Is Texas doing enough to stop moms from dying? And that's what we're talking about today. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call in to Think by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email us, think@kera.org. Marissa, you mentioned a little while ago that some of the money saved by those cuts to state-funded family planning services in 2011 was funneled into other programs that have evolved a couple of times already. Right now, we have the Healthy Texas Women Program. What does that involve?
So the Healthy Texas Women Program is involved with helping women with issues such as getting screened for diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. Also does contraceptive counseling, so for your IUDs or the pill, prenatal care, postpartum care visits, particularly postpartum depression screenings and treatment. So it does a variety of things for that cover women for reproductive health, as well as some of their more primary care help.
You said counseling. If the counselor says, yes, you should get an IUD, does this program pay for that?
It does pay for that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What's required for pregnant women to sign on for Medicaid such as it exists in Texas?
So you need to make sure you're eligible, financially eligible. So you have to meet a certain income requirement. And then from there, you know, it depends on where you're at. So if you qualify for simple, regular Medicaid, then great. But if you are a pregnant woman who maybe makes a little bit too much, you might be able to get into Medicaid for pregnant women, which covers pretty much the same things as regular Medicaid, except two months after you give birth, you are no longer in the program. And that's when the state might transition you over into a different program like the Healthy Texas Woman Program or even the Children's Health Insurance Program, perinatal program. So there are options out there for women, but not every woman who might be low income is eligible because we do have really strict income requirements.
Do any of the cuts that have happened to state family planning services, are they taken up and taken care of by the new kinds of benefits required under the Affordable Care Act?
Some of them are. We still have the family planning program, for example, that's still in existence. The money was cut, but that's still a program that women and even men are eligible for. So if you, for example, do not have access to Medicaid or even the Healthy Texas Women Program, you could still very well get insurance on the healthcare.gov, the federal health exchange. But it's a matter of, will you be able to actually afford the premiums? And that's where a lot of Texas women are having problems, is because they aren't eligible for these public service programs, but they're also not able to afford regular health insurance. And that's where we have a high number of women who are uninsured right now.
I didn't realize that more than half the babies born in Texas are born to mothers on Medicaid.
Yeah, it was a really interesting stat we came across in a couple of reports we were reading. And so that's why we included it. I mean, I think that, you know, people often talk about how Medicaid is such a huge budget buster for Texas and a lot of other states right now, but it really is important to the larger healthcare ecosystem we have in terms of women getting access to care and also babies having access to care too.
So Texas turned down the potential of additional funding that would have made Medicaid benefits available to more low-income people. Was it reasonable to worry that the federal government might not follow through with the promises of continued assistance to states that increase their Medicaid rolls?
Well, you know, I think right now, especially right now with the federal government, you know, everything's up in the air, right? But it's a viable concern. But in terms of what the program offers, I think a lot of advocates right now would say that Texas should have taken the money. It's just a lot of money to leave on the table, a lot of potential uninsured people who would actually have coverage who are still not being covered. It's 1.1 million people right now. So, you know, there's viable concerns to be had about, you know, what will we do if this money were to somehow go away altogether? But, you know, that's why you come up with contingency plans. I think that's where advocates are really wringing their hands right now. We could have come up with a plan. We could have worked together. And, you know, Texas leaders have been really adamant that we're not going to do it. Medicaid expansion is just not on the table for us anymore.
Can undocumented pregnant women get Medicaid?
No. And that's what's interesting. You know, we went down to the border. We were actually in McAllen and Weslaco. And I think there's this perception that part of the reason why our rates are high is that there's all these undocumented women coming in and having their babies, but that's just simply not the case. There's actually a very low number of Hispanic women who are dying after childbirth, which is, you know, really baffled the researchers, but also made them really excited to figure out why that is. So it's actually very difficult for someone who's undocumented to get any type of help or care in the state of Texas.
If they go to the hospital and they're in labor, they mm-hmm. will be treated there. Is that right?
Exactly. Okay. Yes.
All right. I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. First up is John in San Antonio. Hi, John.
Hi. Just with some of the statistics you were talking out about who these women are, being over 40, coming from lower income backgrounds, a lot of those sound like some of the characteristics that might classify a pregnancy as a high-risk pregnancy. So I was wondering how many of these deaths are connected to high-risk pregnancies that maybe we wouldn't have seen 20 or 30 years ago when women giving birth into their 40s was a rarer event.
That's a great question. That's something that we're not really sure about. You know, when we talk to researchers from the task force and when we talk to other women's health experts, the big thing right now has always been, you know, women are waiting longer to have their babies, and which is a big sociocultural change. And we also know that more women are going into their pregnancies with chronic health issues. So thinking of not just heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, but also obesity, also smoking habits. So, you know, a lot of this does have to do with high-risk pregnancies, but, you know, I think the larger theme that researchers continue to point out is that these women do not always have access to help, or they're waiting too long to get their prenatal care because they don't have the money to go or they don't have the resources to go.
Okay, so often we think about prenatal care as being really good for the baby and being really focused on the development of the baby. There's also, you make the note that this is a time when doctors help women get chronic health conditions under control.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think we're having really good conversations right now about that are changing in terms of how do we look at maternal care and how you look at newborn care. There's such a focus on the newborn before, during, and after pregnancy and making sure the baby's healthy. But we're just starting to have conversations about how do we make sure that scale of care is equal for mom and baby. And so that's why those prenatal care appointments are so crucial, because, yes, you want to know that the baby's okay in the womb, but you also want to know that, you know, women are able to take care of themselves. We want to make sure we're managing their diabetes. If they develop gestational diabetes, we want to make sure that we're getting their blood pressure under control, because after they have a baby, that's when they're going to be most at risk for extremely high blood pressure that could be deadly. So that's why prenatal care has been something that's been constantly talked about as we did this project.
And it turns out this postnatal care is the thing that women are more likely, I guess women across the income spectrum, are more likely to blow off after.
Exactly. A big thing we heard was that, you know, like we talked about earlier, you know, you have these women who are so excited to be moms and they're taking care of their babies and making sure their babies are okay, but they're not thinking about themselves. So, you know, if they think of, oh, well, you know, I already went to the doctor, I'm fine, I feel great, you know, I'm going to worry about my newborn, I'm going to make sure my newborn gets to these appointments before I get to these appointments, that's a really big problem. That first year after having a baby is just so crucial for a woman's health. I mean, yes, the days and weeks and even the first month or two are important too, but that first year alone is when you might see those complications arise. So that's why that postpartum appointment is so crucial. But women, for various reasons, don't go. It could just very well be, you know, they're so busy with their newborn, but it could also be, you know, lack of access to transportation, lack of insurance. If they've already had a baby before, they might say, well, I've done this before and, you know, I feel great, I feel fine, and I'm just going to keep taking care of my kid. They're just simply not thinking about how a doctor is going to be able to spot those complications before they might be able to.
It's those postnatal visits are also a good time to discuss birth control if, you know, one baby mm-hmm. in a year or two is enough for people.
Right. That's also why those postpartum visits are just so important. You know, it's not even just about, you know, making sure your blood pressure is okay. It's also about setting you up for your best health. That's something that Dr. Lisa Ollier, the state task force chairwoman, told me during one of our interviews. And that's really just stuck with me because, you know, like I said, I think people just have this idea of, well, postpartum visits are going to be like 15 minutes, making sure I'm okay, making sure I'm on my birth control. But this is also about setting you up for your best health for either your next pregnancy or if you decide not to have your next pregnancy, making sure your body bounces back. And I think right now, you know, a lot of times, especially with the advent of social media, people think they have to have like the snapback body where, you know, their bodies are go back to right the way they were before they got pregnant. But that's just not the case. Some women, it takes longer and that they're going to need help from the doctor and support from their families to get back to where they were.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with Sam in San Antonio. Hi, Sam.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with if there's any correlation between maternal mortality and C-section rates, and just the total idea that you know, birth and childhood shouldn't necessarily be so much revolving around profits, because it seems that C-sections are often done because it's profitable for hospitals. There's also a very, very high rate of vaccinations. We have a huge vaccine schedule, including vaccinations the moment a child is born for hepatitis B, which is something that you only get from intravenous drug use or sex.
Well, Sam, I appreciate your call. And I think much of the conversation today, we're sticking to maternal health. But maybe you can speak, Marissa, to what you learned about a lot of these maternal deaths being related mm-hmm. to C-section complications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for your question, Sam. So C-sections came up quite a bit during our reporting as well. We saw that a lot of women are trying to figure out what's the best delivery method for them. And the problem, but the interesting thing about C-sections is that, you know, oftentimes they're done to help women have their babies quickly. You can actually schedule a C-section. Mm-hmm. You know, you can actually, a doctor can say, what day do you want to have your baby? And you can actually choose a day now if you schedule a C-section. It's convenient. It's easy. You know when the kid's coming. But at the same time, it increases your risk of complications during and after you give birth. It takes a long time to heal from a C-section, you know. And also, if you decide to have another kid again, you might have to have a C-section all over again. Not many doctors do vaginal birth after C-sections. It's a very big risk as well. So, you know, having a C-section is at one part convenient for women and moms, but it's also at the same time a really big risk. And that's why you have complications that can arise and subsequently lead to maternal morbidity, which is a complication, or death.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's jump back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with mm-hmm. Selena in Austin. Hi, Selena.
Hi, Selena. Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had just a question. You mentioned earlier about the various services that Planned Parenthood offered, like reproduction health, STD checks, abortion services. Can you expand mm-hmm. on the type of prenatal care that Planned Parenthood locations offer? Is it expansive enough? Or I can never really find like what the detailed services that they offer for women who decide to go through.
Thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So that's a great question. I think it's important to call your local affiliate who actually does those services. Every affiliate who offers these services might be a bit different. It might be based on availability, but you know, if you look on I'm sure you've seen on their website, if they offer prenatal care, from what my understanding is, it's just the same as you would get at your regular doctor's office. They're going to check on you, they're going to check on the baby, and they're going to answer any questions you might have. So I, from my understanding, it's still the same type of stuff you get at your doctor's office, except Planned Parenthood.
You noted that a few years ago there was discussion in the legislature about expanding eligibility for women who are on Medicaid while pregnant to last for a full year after delivery. What happened to that initiative?
That initiative didn't go anywhere during the legislative session. And that was like a really big disappointment for a lot of women's health advocates I talked to, just because, you know, 2 months after your pregnancy to get for coverage is just, for them, you know, not enough. I mean, just based off our reporting, based off all the research, it shows that women need more support after having a baby. It can't just be 2 months and then she suddenly is without any type of health insurance to go back to her doctor if she has any complications. And so the reason why that's a big deal, though, is because at this point, the legislature is not really willing to spend the money, extra money, on Medicaid, simply because we're already spending quite a bit of money as it is. And so anything related to that might add on to the role, add more people to the roles, or add on to the Medicaid budget is probably going to be a no right now.
All right, back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Jaime in San Antonio. Hi, Jaime.
Hello. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, factor that has not been mentioned in the conversation is the role of substance abuse, usually opioids, and the role that they play in the maternal mortality and morbidity. And the fact that we have here in Bexar County 300 to 400 babies born with the NAS, which is the neonatal substance addicted babies.
Well, thank you very much for your call. What did you learn about that, Marissa?
You know, as the caller just said, you know, that's also a really big factor as well when it comes to maternal mortality in Texas. You have women who are dying from opioid overdoses, unfortunately. I think that there's a will in the legislature to, you know, put more funding and resources to helping women get substance abuse services. So that was something that was interesting to report on because, you know, we're trying to expand substance abuse services at a time when we're in the middle of an opioid crisis. So that is also is a very big factor in our maternal mortality deaths right now, is that women are, when pregnant women, unfortunately, are susceptible to opioid overdoses.
We're talking about what Texas does to stop mothers from dying after giving birth with my guest, Marissa Evans, who reports on health and human services policies for the Texas Tribune. You can find a link to her recent article on the subject at think.kera.org. If you want to call into the show, the number is 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the Texas Tribune's Marissa Evans, who reports on health and human services policies. Her recent article is called Dangerous Deliveries: Is Texas Doing Enough to Stop Moms from Dying? You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. We have a tweet here from Kate, who wants to know if you would talk about how midwifery care has impacted Texas women and infants. We have a number of people who want to ask about doulas. This doesn't come up in the article, Marissa, but I wonder if you've looked into it.
Yeah, we have actually. We went to Weslaco a few months ago. We actually were in a birthing center, and it didn't make it into this story, but there's a story we're working on in the near future on midwifery. And talking to them, you know, a lot of women are eager to have access to a midwife or a doula. I think a lot of women who are pregnant are realizing that they want a different type of support that goes beyond their OBGYN. And I think from my understanding, it's a really good thing because it's one of those things where you can never have too much support for pregnant women in the room. But in terms of how they're impacted, how midwives play, what role they play, you know, midwifery is still considered, so having a midwife is considered a socioeconomic privilege in many respects, unfortunately, because women don't always have the coverage by their insurance. They do not always want to pay out of pocket for a midwife or even a doula. So I think there's a lot of conversations going on right now about how to better integrate midwives and doulas into the conversation around reproductive health so that it's not necessarily just OBGYNs taking on this important mission of how to save women before, during, and after childbirth, but also midwives and doulas too.
Do women who don't have insurance, can they use the services of a midwife and save money that way in a birthing center rather than a hospital?
They can. And that's something that we found as well. You know, the birthing centers are more likely to offer a sliding scale, as it's called. So basically paying what you can based off of your income. And so some of the women we talked to in the birthing center said that, you know, they've had multiple babies at this birthing center, and that it's been really helpful and they felt supported. These birthing centers also often offer child birthing classes and real one-on-one attention, you know. And something I heard while I was at the birthing center was that women feel like they're not just a patient. They feel like it's a real team working with them to have a kid, have their babies. So, you know, I think midwives and doulas are going to play a really critical role in the future of how we look at maternal mortality and how we curb pregnancy complications.
We have a tweet here from Lily who wants to know if there's any relationship between the availability or length of maternity leave and the health of the mother.
That is a great question, actually. You know, it's not something that came up in our reporting. Usually when these pregnancy complications happen after childbirth, it's usually within those first few weeks. So you're right, I guess, at the beginning stages, if you will, of maternity leave, when this might actually happen, unfortunately. But it doesn't mean that there are not conversations to be had about the length of time an American woman might be given for maternity leave versus a woman, say, in Europe, where maternal deaths are actually very low. So those are also important conversations to have as well. You know, how soon are women actually utilizing the full max amount of maternity leave that they have? And do they have the socioeconomic ability to do so?
All right, 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Rico in League City. Hi, Rico.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello.
Being kind of weird just asking this question as a male, but as a partner, husband, and spouse, I was wondering, going back a bit, why there isn't a stronger push on the doctors for VBAC pregnancies versus doing a cesarean and contributing to the possible complications of an additional cesarean on top of a previous one.
Thanks for your call.
It's a great question. So from my understanding, when we talked to doctors and just other interviews, you know, the big deal was that, you know, they don't want to take that risk of having it be done as a vaginal birth versus a cesarean. So that was just kind of the big thing. They just don't want to take the risk. Now, it's not to say that those doctors don't exist. They're just very hard to find. We actually went out to Abilene at one point and we were shadowing a doula for the day, actually. And she was telling me that there is a doctor in Dallas who does VBACs and he's been doing them for years. And when you sit in his office, there are women who come from all over the country to get a consultation by him and to get his help. So not just women from all across Texas, you have women who came from like Milwaukee and Indiana and all these other states to get his help and to seek his guidance. So there is definitely a will by women who want to get pregnant again to have VBACs. It's just a matter of they might have to go outside of their doctor to actually get it done.
If the problem of postpartum mortality is on the rise in many parts of the country, what have you learned about the ways that other states are trying to deal with this?
A big thing that I heard about during our reporting was the number of states that are trying to make sure women have access to services. You know, it's really hard to curb maternal mortality if you have women who are going into their pregnancies with all these chronic health issues that are not being addressed. So California, you know, as much as I think people joke about how Texas doesn't like California or doesn't want to be like California, California has been doing a great work in the public health space when it comes to maternal mortality. So they have a collaborative, they also have their own task forces, but, you know, they're working with hospitals and really corralling hospitals together saying, what can we do? What data can we share? And what procedures can we put in place? So they've put in place stuff for hemorrhaging. They're working on some even more stuff related to high blood pressure. So for women who've just recently given birth. So all of these things are happening in California. In Texas, we're kind of just getting to that point. We are joining these similar collaboratives and we're trying to create our own bundles, so-called bundles and procedures that will help with hemorrhaging, help with opioid usage, things like that.
So it's just like an encouragement to be aware of all the potential complications. I want to make sure I understand how these bundles work.
Right. So bundles are considered procedures that are known to work, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it could be a matter of a hospital always having a kit nearby for when someone might be dealing with high blood pressure right after giving birth, so postpartum preeclampsia. It might very well be, you know, having kits for when someone is hemorrhaging. So the point of the bundles is that hospitals will implement them, these best practices, and take care of women using these best practices. So for Texas, we are just starting the process of getting bundles together for opioids, for hemorrhaging, and I believe high blood pressure, so postpartum preeclampsia. So we're taking those steps right now, and the goal is that we're going to get as many hospitals as possible in Texas to want to participate, because the good thing is most hospitals probably already have their own protocols in place, but there's no blanket way of having these protocols.
All right, back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Heather is calling from San Antonio. Hi, Heather.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just had a couple comments. One is, here in San Antonio, I know of at least one practice that midwifery practice that takes Texas Medicaid as well as Texas Women Healthy Women's Insurance. So, making a comment that generally, yes, midwives, you know, it's maybe a luxury for those who have more money, but there are practices where, you know, Medicaid and those are accepted by those different practices. So I know of at least one here in San Antonio that does take that, and there are midwives and they birth in the hospital, so they do use those type of, you know, those different type of practices that midwives do that maybe will be GYN and don't.
Well, thank you very much for that, Heather. It's good to know that it's out there. I guess it's just a matter of having to look around to find someone who might accept payment this way.
Agreed. Yeah, I agree. There are some practices that do indeed take Medicaid. And like I said, the sliding scale services as well. So not every midwife or doula requires you to pay out of pocket. So some actually do take that insurance. So thank you for making that point.
Does that care by a midwife or doula extend much beyond the delivery and the time one would go back home with the baby?
A little bit. You know, depending on the birthing center, depending on who you go to for as your midwife or doula, oftentimes there's a home visit right after you give birth. And not just, you know, in a few weeks they'll visit you. It's like within a couple of days they're at your home. They're checking on you. They're checking on the baby. They're asking you questions, making sure you're eating, making sure you're sleeping, you know, and just generally there to help with any questions you might have. And so I think that's why there's a great push right now to get more midwives and doulas involved in the Texas health reproductive health ecosystem, because, you know, they can actually be on the front lines for women after they leave that hospital, more so than, say, maybe an OBGYN can, because typically within 4 to 6 weeks you are getting your postpartum care visit, which is great and important, but, you know, the doctor isn't there in those first couple of days or first few days after you give birth. And that's why midwives and doulas are considered so important, because they're right there with you and they'll continue going back to your home to come visit you.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Marissa, why does Texas still have the country's highest rate of uninsured women? I don't know if that's still true for other groups, but it is true for women 18 to 64.
Mm-hmm. I think part of that, the reason that is because partly because we didn't expand Medicaid. I think every other healthcare advocate you talk to continues to go back to how lack of access to care, and particularly for women of low income, is a factor in how Medicaid expansion could actually help fix that. Not fix everything, of course. It's not the end all be all, but it would greatly help if it means 1.1 million people will suddenly have coverage. I think another part of it as well is, you know, the high premiums. You know, the idea of the Affordable Care Act was that everybody was going to be able to get insurance in some form or fashion. And there are many, many people who just haven't been able to find a plan that works for them and their budget. A lot of people who still do not see the point of health insurance because they don't get sick enough to really utilize it, or they're paying so much. They have to pay so much for health insurance that they're choosing the lowest plan that doesn't offer the most coverage. So it's a variety of things right now. We're having really good conversations around health insurance, and we're actually educating more people than ever on what health insurance is and what it isn't and what it can do and what it can't do. But it's going to take a lot of time for Texas, I think, to help people, because I think that there's stigma around what the Affordable Care Act is. I mean, I think there was that great TV segment done on people who talking about the Affordable Care Act and how they don't like it, but they do like Obamacare.
Or so vice versa, right? Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I think that we're still trying to educate people on what it does. We're still trying to get rid of the social and political stigma about what the legislation does and what it can do for you.
So another statistic you quote is the fact that more than a third of births in Texas are to women who did not intend to become pregnant. At the risk of asking a really dumb question, what can you tell us about why these women were not using birth control if they weren't looking to have a baby?
Something I heard from advocates over and over again, I mean, we talked to dozens and dozens of people for this particular project, is access to birth control. You know, it's not necessarily about, you know, they did or did not want to get pregnant. It was, they might not have had birth control to even just prevent it. And, you know, I think that there's this idea, well, they can just get the pill, right? You know, the pill is affordable. The pill doesn't cost as much as an IUD. On the surface, yes, but when you think about the amount of pills you might need over the course of a month, if you have to keep getting it, if it's $40 a month, that's a lot of money for someone who might be low income or might have a very, very tight budget. So affordable access to birth control was a big factor that we talked about, that we heard from our interviewees about. We also heard about simply, you know, not being able to get to the doctor. So to even have those conversations about birth control or have an idea of what their options might be. Another thing too is, you know, long-acting reversible contraceptives, so like an IUD, you know, we're still having a lot of conversations with women about what it is and trying to fight stigma around what it can and cannot do and what are some of the potential side effects of it. So I think doctors right now are having a interesting time not only educating themselves on what LARCs can do, but also making sure their patients are equipped with the knowledge of what might be the best birth control for them to pick.
Are these rising maternal mortality rates something that state lawmakers are paying close attention to?
That's a great question. I think that they have probably read my story. I have not seen many who have shared my story, but I think that they know it's an issue. I think they realize that not only is the Texas Tribune, but Texas media in general is going to be continuing to keep them accountable on this issue and why they're not doing more. I think that they're aware. I think that they want more data on, I think the data point is a big issue, trying to figure out, reconcile what is the truest data out there, as well as what are the solutions. And before they go and spend more money on getting women healthcare services, they really want to know that they're spending that money in the right place.
Marissa Evans reports on health and human services policies for the Texas Tribune. You can find a link to her recent article on whether Texas is doing enough to stop moms from dying after childbirth at think.kera.org. Marissa, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the podcast and archives of the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.